Hello, welcome back to the Haworth Timber and Building Supplies 1840 podcast. I'm your host, Paul Bullivant, and today I'm delighted to be joined by David Campion. David's a former professional squash player and world junior finalist. He joined the England squash coaching team in 2000, where he served as head coach of the England squash team for 23 years. Under his leadership, England secured 25 medals across four Commonwealth Games, became world team champions five times, and European team champions 42 times at both junior and senior levels. So it's a real honour to have David with us today. And what we're going to be doing is talking about some of the lessons that David's learnt through elite coaching over the last 20 plus years, and how what he's learnt can be applied to any sport, any business, and any personal development situation. So David, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, good morning, Paul. Great to be here.
Thanks for having me. You're very welcome. Let's jump straight in. Where did it all start?
My background is I started at seven and a half. I was very fortunate. I was kind of born into an area where there was a top coach. Okay. And, it's just a really good environment. So that was the first thing. Had a prolific junior career and then got to 18. As you said, final of the world junior championships, went on to professional tour. I was doing very well. I mean, I guess because I was talented, and the problem with myself, really, I made a lot of mistakes. So when transitioning from a top junior to world-class senior professionally is like a really difficult task.
Yeah.
And I think I made a lot of mistakes.
Are you going to share some of those mistakes?
I was very gifted. I was very skillful. Yeah. Ball control skill, racket skills was my strength. My body kind of let me down. I didn't have probably genetics of some of my peers at the time. I wasn't physically blessed, if you like. I was reasonably okay, but back then, I guess 35 years ago, you didn't have the sports science backup that we've got today. You know, sport has evolved; it's moved on a lot. If you look at the body shapes of footballers, rugby players, it's all very different. So the information back then, 35 years ago, wasn't as it is today. However, neither did I really go seeking. So it's more my mindset, really. I didn't have this kind of inquisitive, curious thing. Everything just came naturally to me.
Just going back to the physical side of things, what didn't help you progress?
Injuries. So I didn't strengthen. So the squash is very one-sided, for example. You know, you're playing, it's a racket sport. You're the right or left-handed. So the right side of the body gets built up. Yep. You know, you lunge a bit more on your favoured racket side. So the imbalances that you get, the pelvic rotates, and without getting too technical, I just had a lot of lower back and hip issues. We talk a lot about kind of activation, glute strength, you know, prehab, rehab.
Yeah.
A lot of our players today, they see the physio every week without fail, and it's more kind of proactive as opposed to reactive.
I'm interested in glutes because of my own struggles with glutes. I want to ask you about glutes and hips, because working in an office and doing a lot of driving, that's a real problem for glutes and hips, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's actually the biggest muscle in your body. And when you lunge, when you're walking around, you've got to strengthen glutes. But also, it's not just strengthening; it's having strength at range. So in squash, for example, you talk about glutes and hips. You need to be able to be strong and powerful, and that means lifting, using weights and things like that. But you need to be strong at range because you're accelerating, decelerating, getting into a deep lunge and then pushing back out again in squash, for example. So you need that strength at range. So it's no point being strong and not flexible, and it's no point being flexible and not strong. Either way, you're going to break down.
Okay. But in my life, sat at my desk and sat at the car, what would your advice be to me?
Just good mobility, really. Mobility, just range of motion, that sort of thing. I mean, we do a lot with the players these days. We do a lot of glute activation, band work, TheraBand work, just firing the glutes and just making sure they're strong, because that's and the core as well, because everything runs through all movements, whatever you do in life, it runs through the core area. And I think that's an important thing to remember. It's very important.
So everything that I'm doing is just totally wrong then. Sat at the desk, sat at the car, no core work, no mobility work, no glute work. I'm destined for a lifetime of back pain.
It's not going to be helpful, put it that way.
That's very positive and a great start. Thank you. So you've got the skills, you've not got the genetics, and you didn't do the work.
I was breaking down, injuries. I'd go off and play a tournament. Yeah. I'd get a big match. I'd beat somebody in the top 20, 30 in the world, but then I'd be through to the next round and I was breaking down. I just didn't have the body to cope the demands of the sport, really. So I started coaching at 21.
Had you decided to stop playing
Not really. I was supplementing my income. All my eggs were in but one basket, really. I was a squash player, and that's what I wanted to do. I had a strong passion for that. The family was all in squash. But I just, my body was breaking down. And so I started coaching. I didn't really want to coach. You know, I wanted to play. It was to supplement my income. And then I think I found that, you know, I was getting a little bit of success, early success. And a lot of my kind of rivals and peers started coming, having coaching with me. Because I was kind of off the scene competitively. So that was okay for them.
What were your early successes?
I mean, in tournaments, I wasn't getting to play the very, very top players, like the world, the Jahangir Khans and the top players. But I mean, I was playing guys in the top 10.
Okay.
I mean, I had three wins against the top 10.
So you're talking about success, your early successes in coaching?
Oh, in coaching.
Yeah, what were the early successes that you came across?
I would say just things like young players that were coming to me. I mean, a lot of the Yorkshire teams, junior teams, were players that I was involved with, that I was helping.
Yeah. And where were your early wins? Were they in the more the technique side? Was it in the fitness side? Was it in the mindset side of things?
I would say in the technical side, because that was my strength. I was a young coach. Yeah. I mean, you know, I found out much later on through trial and error that wasn't, you know, I went from being a really technical coach. I mean, I still am a technical coach because I think technique is important. It's fundamental, but there's so much more to it, which we can get into. But I had some early success, and then some professionals started coming to be based. So I had a little stable of professionals.
Oh, nice.
But I was still like similar ages to them. It's weird, really, because, and then I started having, you know, getting noticed by one or two of the high profile coaches and worked with England. David Pearson at the time was head coach, and he invited me in to work with some of his players on national squads. So I was kind of assisting, and I was very young. I mean, I was like mid to late 20s that was helping out. And to me, it was all very, you know, I was all very new to it all. So it was a great learning opportunity. And I got to work with some really high level players from that. And then I think 29, I got the National Junior Coach's job. So the year 2000, I was head coach for the National Junior Teams for about 10 years. I had a lot of success. You know, a couple of those World Junior title championship wins came from the junior side of things, which I was involved with. And a lot of the players that you know, we had what we call a world-class potential program, and I was kind of leading that. And, you know, the head coaches were kind of more looking after the senior end, and I was running a lot of the junior side of things with another coach. And I guess we had a lot of success in terms of not just winning things with junior teams at European and world level. Commonwealth Youth Game goals, we won that as well in Edinburgh.
Had you stopped playing professionally
pretty much,
at this point?
Yeah, I'd stopped playing, yeah.
Was there a point that you remember where you'd flick the switch from player to coach?
Not really. It just kind of morphed into it. The coaching was taking off.
Yeah.
It was taking up a lot of time. The playing, you know, I didn't have the aspirations anymore to really seek and be curious and sort myself, you know, the years had gone by.
It was just a natural migration.
Yeah, and I wasn't bitter about it. You know, but the best thing about all this was that my brother, when he was born, he was 12 when he was born, and he became, so I got to the final of the World Juniors I was 18, he was 6.
Okay.
And then he became a prolific junior himself. But obviously with my mistakes, my kind of failures, if you like, I was really determined that he didn't make those same mistakes.
Yeah.
Sports science was a little bit more readily available. Yeah. So we engaged sports science with him. You know, we had a strength and conditioning coach working with him, making sure that he was doing all the right things and not making the mistakes I was making. And I guess that benefited the program overall. I mean, all our young players, it was maybe through my failings that I insisted, you know, we insisted, England Squash insisted that we had this within the program. So it wasn't just about teaching them squash.
Was he always going to be coached by you? Or did the brother relationship ever become an issue?
No, not at all. I mean, his father was my original coach, my stepfather. Yep. Was, and then, you know, together we worked on James, and I was a coach in my own right. So James would spend a lot of time with me as well. I'd travel around to tournaments with him. He'd come and see me at my base in my stable in Halifax. And, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about his game and going through the whole thing of being
a
player.
It was a good relationship then, because a lot of brothers would struggle, a younger brother would struggle to take advice from a
Yeah, not at all. We had, honestly, a really good relationship. I mean, I don't know, like, I guess because he was good and I could see the potential and I could see myself, you know, I, at a young age, I was winning titles and, like, say, in world junior finals and things, and he was even better than me. And I'm thinking, well, you know, he could really go right through it. But, you know, so the education piece wasn't so much just about his squash and hitting the ball. It was all around the peripheral things, you know, the nutrition, the recovery, the I mean, all the things now that the sports science industry, you know, the backup now that you get as an elite athlete, I mean, sport evolves, doesn't it?
Yeah, massively, and okay.
The information that's available. I mean, we got involved with the English Institute of Sport. We were backed by Sport England and UK Sport. Sport England mainly, actually. It's UK Sport now. But they provided us with, after the Commonwealth Games in 2002, the English Institute of Sport was formed. And these are world-class sports scientists that work with cycling, you know, all the mainstream sports. Okay. And we've had a lot of professional help as a sport with that. And I think our program in England was probably, you know, with my background and things what happened to me, and obviously the influx of this professional help, you know, and this sports science, sports medicine, some of the best doctors and physiologists and strength and conditioning coaches, nutritionists, psychologists, sports psychologists. We had the best help. It's probably the best, I would say it was the best program in the world.
What challenges did you have transitioning from player to coach at the time when sports science was developing, you know, rapidly? What were the main things that you had to learn to turn you into a world-class coach?
Well, I was quite fortunate in a way that when the EIS got involved with squash, and you know, we had a lot of, when I say sports science, it wasn't just necessarily on the physical side. You know, we had a guy who came work with us for about 4 years, a guy called David Young,
okay.
And he's now with Man City. He's their sports psychologist. Right. He was actually a level 4 cricket coach, a very good cricket coach, and he became a very good high level sports psychologist. Yeah. And we had him for about 4 years, and he was like a mentor to me, really. So, you know, we talk about coaching a lot. I mean, he's been with England cricket for years. He's been, like I say, I mean, he was excellent. I mean, he didn't just work with the players; he worked with the coaches. He helped us shape things within the program,
okay.
How we did things. You know, the delivery, the environment. We talked. I mean, we set up the environment together when we formed the England Academy in Manchester at the National Centre. He was very much a integral part of that. You know, so it wasn't just squash. It was
sport in general. So your growth came from natural curiosity, education, I guess, and then just good mentorship from people around you.
Yeah, and it, all about how do we affect change?
Okay.
You know, how do we set the conditions to allow people to flourish?
Yeah.
So it's not just about how well you hit a ball. That's what I mean about in my early days, I always judge people on how well they hit a squash ball, or how, you know, the kind of skill element. You know, that was kind of my kind of how I looked at things. But later on, I realized it was much more about, you know, the behaviors and actions that we take. How do certain people go through and become world-class, high level?
Yeah, okay.
And why do others, you know, because I've seen so many people that are so talented like myself not make it through. And yet I've seen so many people that also come through, conversely, that don't look like eye candy on a squash court, and they do come through and become, you know, world's best.
Can we'll come back to that point, what makes the difference between good and world-class. I just want to finish the story with your brother. So he's coming through, you're rapidly growing as a coach and developing your style, he's developing his game. What's the end of his story? Where did he get to?
He was a prolific junior, world junior champion. So he went one better than me. I was silver medalist. He got the gold.
Does he ever remind you of that?
No, well, I'm sure he did. I mean, it's fine. Honestly, I was well past it all by the time he got through. But yeah, he went on to become gold medalist, Commonwealth Games 2018, Gold Coast. He world number one. You know, he's won virtually every major title you can win. Yeah, he made it to the very highest levels in the game. And
how did you feel about that as you're coming through? Because obviously you'd started early, you'd won, you'd got silver in the World Junior Games tournament, and then your brothers. Then you've decided I've not quite got that edge to get to the next level. So you've made your decision to move on. Then your brothers come on and kind of fulfilled all the things that you might have wanted to go to.
Yeah.
Was there any? Did you ever feel jealous? Was there ever any issues between the two of you?
No. It wasn't like it was quite new to me. You know, I'd been out of the game for a while, for quite a long time, and the fact that I had a younger brother was this good, was exciting. You know, family. So I can help. And I can help educate in the areas that he's going to need educating, mm-hmm. because I know what it's like. Yeah. I've been there. I know what the failures look like. So,
did you ever feel any regret as you kind of came to the realization that you'd not got that extra 1% that would take you to the next level?
Yeah, I just wasn't curious enough. I think that's the thing that, you know, when I coach your player now, and I have this is what I do. I mean, they need to be curious, because it's not about me imposing and telling them what to do. They've got to take some ownership and responsibility.
What does that look like? So to any young, anybody watching, or anybody who's got a child or what have you, who are good at a sport.
Yeah, my best piece of advice for anyone with a young, aspiring young player, a young athlete, is there's no such thing as a high performance 11-year-old or a world-class 13-year-old. It's not even, that is irrelevant to me.
Okay.
What it is, it's how curious and how their passion, their desire to get better at something.
Yeah.
So, talent is, what's talent really? The talent could be mindset. Talent is just because you look quite good. That's like a visual thing. Mm-hmm. But what's actually going on inside? How much learning is taking place? How much growth? So as coaches, as leaders, are we facilitating that kind of growth?
So I'm just taking a coaching qualification. So curiosity is something that we regularly get taught about. So I'm really interested in curiosity.
Yeah.
For a young person, 11, 12, 13, 14, who's good at whatever sport they do, what's good curiosity? What would you expect somebody of that age to be doing to show their curiousness and learn?
I mean, look, the first and foremost is, I think when you're young, it's about having fun. So it's not that you're going to grab all of an 8-year-old and say, right, you need to be asking questions.
Yep.
It's got to be fun. You need that ignition, that passion.
Yep.
That's the first thing. So I'm kind of talking about, once that phase has gone, what I call the early phase of fun, igniting the passion. As a coach, we want to be set in an environment where kids can have fun and they want to come back because they've enjoyed themselves. But the thing about this is that they're going to enjoy winning. Kids enjoy having fun and participating, but when they get better at something, they want to keep going back. So that's how we get them to be better. Now that's a fine skill. That's a fine balance. It's about, like in sport, it's a fine balance between having fun, but then growth and learning.
Can you teach curiosity, or is it a natural trait?
No, I think everything's trainable. Everything's trainable. So it'll be things like, for example, I can give a practical example. I would, if a player is playing and they lose, or if they can't perform a certain skill, I would ask them why. So why is probably one of the biggest things. You've got to ask why.
Yep.
How did I win? Why did I lose? Why can't I hit this certain shot? Why can't I do this task or this certain skill? Okay, and then you examine that, you investigate, you realign, you learn from that, you grow, you move on. And this is why I think, losing a squash match, when people talk about failure to me is not really something that exists unless it's catastrophic. Yep. Failure is like an atomic bomb. That's it. It's the end. Losing is part of winning, if that makes sense. So the World Number One's lose. My brother did a lot of losing to get to World Number One. He did a lot more losing, or as much losing, maybe not quite as much, but he still did a lot of losing when he was World Number One. Okay, so World Number One's lose. The best players lose. Michael Jordan won 6 NBAs. Okay, what happened to the other 9 that didn't win? Does that make him a failure? So success is part of, or failure is part of success, if you like.
So part of that curiosity with a young person is to get them to own what they're doing and ask questions and reflect on what
it requires ownership. It's getting mastery. You need to be mastery. So I wasn't particularly, I'd say, mastery. I mean, I loved hitting a ball. I was mastery in that sense, but I wasn't mastery about many other things. And I think as coaches, as facilitators of learning, growth, leaders, if you like, we've got to open those doors and ask the questions, okay, you're not able to perform this skill. Why is that then? Well, and then it just leads to something else, and you just raise their awareness. So what I do, I just raise self-awareness. If you raise self-awareness and you make them aware, they might come to me for a lesson. Say, for example, a typical coach in a club, you pay for an hour lesson and you go away and you come back in the following week and you pay another hour.
Yep.
And for that hour, you get information and you practice. Now, that's a transactional situation. What if it's more transformational than that? So you set the conditions for growth and raise self-awareness and they take ownership. So then the learning takes place far more when they've left you.
Outside, yeah.
Yeah, for that hour, you've got the growth and the learning, but then they're going home and they're going, right, I want to master this. And it becomes mastery, it becomes a mastery thing, and they take ownership of it. And that's how you get resilience.
Okay.
Because people want to do things for longer. It's sustainable.
So you've been England coach. You were England coach for 23 years.
With it, I was in England for 23 years. I was the head national junior coach for 10.
Okay.
And then I was assistant with the seniors for 3 or 4, and then became head coach for the seniors. So I've worked in with England teams, junior and senior, for 23 years.
Yeah. Are you still as curious today as you were 23 years ago?
I'm more curious. I'm as curious. I'm a lot more curious than I was when I was 18. I wasn't curious. So I think curiosity is a big thing.
Why are you as curious today as back then?
Because I can see a difference it makes.
Right.
So if I've got a player in front of me now, and I've started coaching one or two kids that come over from China recently. I'm an Olympic program consultant for the Italian Squash Federation. So I go over there 5 days every other month and I help them. They've got their Olympic program in place. I've helped them design that. But when I go over there, it's not like I'm telling all the players what to do. You know, I'm getting invested in them, understanding what it is they're good at, what they're not so good at, what's their identity. You know, how can we make that player a better player? How can I raise their self-awareness? Because I'm there for 5 days every other month. And how can I raise the awareness of the coaches?
When you're not there.
Yeah. So then it becomes like, if you're the only person delivering, doing the one thing, but you've got several of the people in the team and the room that are doing the same thing, similar things, then you're going to get an accelerated growth.
So the first big piece of advice to our listeners and viewers today is stay curious.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's the holy grail of elite sport.
Curiosity.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
It's interesting because when you listen to any of the kind of the high performance podcasts or the sporting guys, there's lots of talk about resilience.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like resilience is the number one trait of the elite.
Yeah.
But where
do you get resilience from? That's my question. Where does resilience come from?
That ability to bounce back from the negative, I guess, comes from reflection and self-learning, which I guess is the curiosity.
Resilience is when you've got some ownership of it and it's sustainable. So for example, a training week for an athlete, if they're training really hard every day, every single day, they're going to burn out, they're going to get injured. There's no lasting resilience in that. So we talk a lot about recovery, having a hard day, medium day, light day, hard day, recovery, nutrition. Could then push hard on the hard days, you know, go a bit lighter on the days so you can recover and then go hard again. And then you get long-term resilience. So, and also it's because if they have a say in how it's done as well. So rather than me say, I want you doing this, you're imposing. Who works well to have things imposed upon them? You know, it's more about, okay, well, let's go on a journey together. What's your identity? Who are you? You know, what's your strengths?
Interesting.
You know, like if you look at Nadal and Federer, two complete opposites.
Yep.
Nadal's like the baseline, powerful, physical, hard-hitting, whereas Federer was the kind of artist, the skilled player. I mean, my brother James was the artist, for example. You know, and a lot of his rivals would have other strengths. So you need to know who you are, what's your identity, and how do you want to play? How would you like to play the game?
And you put that down to that's curiosity.
But when you're asking these questions, they have to answer them. So, you know, you kind of build this self-awareness, and then I think people get more curious on that.
Okay. So it's questioning people, encouraging self-awareness, which leads to the curiosity to find your own answers.
Yeah, and you want problem solvers. You want independent thinkers and you want problem solvers. And I mean, Ali Farag, who's a current world number one, he wrote an article recently. He's got an engineering degree from Harvard. He went to Harvard. Got an engineer and he's world number one squash player. And he said he uses his background in engineering because it's all about solving problems. I have a problem in front of me. I've got to solve it. I've got a player who's making it really uncomfortable for me on court. I need to solve this. How can I stop them from volleying? You know, how can I restrict them, or how can I, you know, outfox them here?
Yeah, okay. So this, before we did this, I asked for some questions from any viewers who wish to throw something in. And I got a surprising amount of questions back. There's one here from Ash Cookson, who has a business called Protivity, and he's a personal coach and works in leadership development. So I'm to ask you his question, because it touches on all of these things. Appreciating that all elements are required to some degree, but which of the following is most critical for sustainable superior performance? Mindset, skill set, or physiology? And which is the most important to coach? So you've touched on all three of those. And I don't want the answer of they're all equally the same. There must be one that you personally think is the key one. Mindset, skill set, physiology.
Well, if you want to improve a skill, where does that come from? That comes from mindset, because it requires a lot of purposeful, deliberate, focused practice. And you can't do that if you're not focused. So you've got to have the mindset in order to be able to develop a skill. Okay. Skill set is crucial. It's crucial. You know, having good technique and good decision-making skills, you know, the skill acquisition side of the game or any sport or anything you do, that's crucial. But where does that come from? It comes from being ignited, having passion, and then having the kind of the rage to master something, if you like, you know, the mastery. But that comes from the mindset. So I would say regardless of how good you are, and I was that person that was the talented, okay, maybe the physiology, but the mindset wasn't, you know, was letting me down. Whereas my brother, he was probably brought up in a slightly different way. So instead of maybe being told how good he was, or the people around him saying how good he was, it's like, well, how are you applying yourself?
So mindset is the foundation.
Yeah, and
of
I think
get
you know,
the mindset right and
mindset, and there's a very good study by Dweck, 2007. Around mindset. There's a book actually written about this, but this was done at Stanford University. And what happened was that they tutored, the teachers taught the kids, well, students, should I say, not the kids, the students at university at Stanford. Half the year group were praised on effort and application.
Okay.
And half the group were taught on results. So they were tested regularly and then just basically praised on how well they did and their test results. So what happened over the course of the year, at the end of the year, they did one big test and the students didn't know how they're being taught. The teachers knew, but they were split academically equally. I think there was like 200 and 200, but they were split equally or whatever. And the group that were taught on effort and application, praise on effort and application, outperformed the other group by 80%.
Interesting.
And there were, I mean, they weren't, I want to say astounded, that they were astounded by the gap. It was a huge gap. Considering these started the year as equal academically, yeah, yeah. By the end of the semester or whatever it was, or the end of the term, it was 80% to 80-20. So they did it again in another university, the same results. Took it around different parts of America. And apparently that helped shape how they're taught in schools today. So, and you know, big life lessons on that. And again, when you're talking about saying to people how talented you are, and I had that all my young life, really. And I'm not saying from my family, it was more, you hear it all the time. And it's probably the worst thing, really. I mean, yeah, give confidence to someone. You've done well and praise, you know, okay, you won that tournament or you've done this. But the winning comes from the daily work, the daily grind, all the fluffy stuff that you see, these top players winning things. You know, my brother would get into world number one, all the fluffy stuff. It's everything beneath that. The stuff that things that you don't see, that the graft and the hard yards, and that requires a lot of mindset and effort and application focus.
So in answer to Ash, mindset first, set the foundation, everything grows off that.
It comes from that. And as leaders, facilitators, coaches, how do we set the conditions for that growth? You know, that's how we interact with them, how behaviors and how we behave and act.
Okay, so touching on that point of how you set the. Just tell me how you phrase it.
Set the conditions.
So how you set the conditions for success. This was from Chris Simpson, who is somebody who you have coached in the past. And he'd sent a question in that isn't a question, that he says it wasn't a question. So he goes, not a question, but a great lesson. Not a question, but a great lesson Camps taught me, which has served me well in sporting and business life. If you're not 15 minutes early, you're late.
Yeah.
We've talked about that before we started filming, and this is part of how you set your store.
Yeah, part of the environment. So when he says Camps, that's my nickname.
So I guess that was a couple of people who've called you Camps.
Yeah, so. That's my name. So yeah, basically say I used to coach Chris. He's now a financial planner with Mazars. He was a world top 20 player. I mean, it's good that he said that. I mean, I can't remember the exact conversation, but that is something I would say to the players. You know, if you're 15 minutes early, you're actually late. And if I explain that, what I mean by that is if we're starting at a session at 9:30 and you arrive at 9:15 and you think you're on time, I would ask you this question. I would say, and this is what I did with the players. I'd just ask them the question. I'd say, right. And they would give me the answer. So, right. So just tell me, are you going to be ready in 15 minutes? They say, oh yeah, yeah, I'll be ready. Right. Okay. So you need to get changed. You need to get your drinks bottle. You need to get your rackets ready. Maybe to stick a new grip on. Go and do your warm up. Then you've got to do your mobility. Then you've got to do your dynamic stretch. And then you've got to do your ghost and your agility work to get that kind of ballistic thing ready to start the session. You've got to be mentally and physically at your best. Because remember, we're talking world class. I mean, this is, I'm talking with the pros or you know. But even a young player, you know, if you want to be, if you've got aspirations.
Even beyond the sporting realm, getting your mindset right before you go into a, in a business sense, before you go into a meeting, not just turning up with 1 minute to go, having the chance to get yourself ready before you start. Is the same
you've got to get yourself into that performance, you know. It's a
mindset again.
Yeah, well, if you're training to perform that high-level match that you're going to be in, you've got to train that way. Yeah. You have to. I'm not saying it's got to be completely intense and hard work all the time and get the burnout. You don't get the long-term resilience from that. You know, but I'm talking about like even doing low-level glute activation or low-level solo practice or whatever task it is you're completing. It's about applying yourself because there's no room for, you know, 500 world-class players. There's only room for maybe 10, mm-hmm. you know, top 10 in the world. That's world-class. So do you want to be world-class or not? So I would say to players, look, you know, so you tell me, are you going to be ready in 15 minutes? And of course, their answer is, well, no. You might be ready, but you're not really ready. You're not ready to, you know, because being world-class or being high level is about doing things to the highest of standards consistently. That's all it is. It's as simple as that. Yeah.
And you rigorously applied that to everybody, didn't you?
Yeah, but I wouldn't enforce that. When I say enforce it, I'd say, well, you told me you want to be top 10 in the world. So do those behaviours and those actions match your goal? And I said, well, no. So, okay, well, either lower your goal or change your behaviours. So of course, they change the behaviours if they've got aspirations. So they tell me what they want to do.
But that basic set of behaviours that set the standard that allow a good mindset for curiosity and growth, were they non-negotiable?
Well, again, it's up to them. I would say, look, if we were starting at 9:30, I'd be like, look, I'm going to bring my A game to this session and I need you to bring yours. So who's the energy coming from? Is it coming from me or is it coming from you or is it coming from both? And I think when you get it from both, that's when you can really accelerate.
So in the just kind of go with me on this because it's not the perfect scenario, but it's the best way I can describe it.
Yeah.
You've got... coaching a group of 10 people, you have the world number one who is just the best in the world by a long chalk.
Yeah.
And your 10th is world number 200, just coming along to just learn. Yeah. Would you apply exactly the same rules to number one as number two? So would you make allowances for number one because he's so talented, even though you believe being 45 minutes early is an absolute prerequisite?
No, it's habits. So I would say, yeah, that's it. I mean, anyone I coach knows that if we're starting at 9:30, I mean 9:30. And if you are going to be 5-10 minutes late, fine. If you've got a puncture or something like that, that's fine. I'm not talking. But you know, is it about 9:30 or is it 9:30?
And would you make allowances for somebody who's incredibly talented? No. World number one.
No, not at all.
Same rules apply to everybody.
Yeah, that's the time we're starting. And if you're in a training group and you're just wasting other people's time. Wasting yourself as well, because I know that you're not going to be ready mentally and physically
to go.
So particularly mentally. So if we're looking for standards like this in terms of like we were going for gold medals. You know, we're looking for world top players. Yeah, you know, that we're being funded by Sport England. You know, we're in a position of authority here where we've got to set the standards. So yeah, you know, we created this environment where players knew. So in terms of a non-negotiable, it kind of is, but. It's got to come from them because I would then say.
Yeah, but you have to set you as coach. You want people to buy into it and make it their rules.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you have to set the standard initially. Have you any other non-negotiables that are just that basic to set the?
I mean, let me just go back to it on that very quickly. So I would say to the players, how long do you need to get ready? So some players would. Nick Matthew, for example, who was 3 times world champion. He was a big rival of my brother's, but he was meticulous. I mean, he'd do like shoulder things and all sorts of stuff. He'd have a hockey ball under his ball of his foot for the nerve endings. I mean, he went to like extreme preparation lengths. Now he would want 45 minutes. So he would arrive. So it's not like everyone's got to arrive starting at 9:30. Everyone needs to be there by 8:45. You've got to be ready at 9:30 mentally and physically at your best.
Yeah.
So that's it. And then if they needed 30 minutes or 45 minutes or an hour, then it's up to them. They can arrive at whatever time.
And that's the curiosity thing.
Yeah.
And self-awareness to learn what you need to do.
Yeah, so they set their own, but we are setting the conditions and they set their own agenda to that.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Have you any other non-negotiables as part of the team? So today's to talk about sport and squash, but obviously from what I see, a lot of what you can learn out in sport, you can apply into business, into any situation. Have you any other non-negotiables that you think help set the stall out for a great team?
Yeah, I would say I would say that everyone needs to be heard as well. That's the thing. Because if I'm speaking all the time and I'm saying, you know, we need to do it like this and this, you know, and that's what I believe. How do you know? And I'm in a position of authority, and these, I'm making funding decisions on players, selection decisions for England. Mm-hmm. I've got a team of people, physios, assistant coaches, you know, that they're, everyone's kind of under the umbrella, if you like. And if I'm just saying, well, I believe we need to do this. First of all, I'm influencing that what they think. And isn't it better if everyone can have a bit of a voice and then I can get to understand what they actually think? And these are experts in their yep. field. Yep. I need to, I could say to the S&C guy, look, Keith, what do you think about the last performance from so-and-so, you know, 1-1, you know, what happened there? And he said, well, this is what happened. His endurance is lacking. He fell away. We've got to work on this. His strength is okay, but we've got to work on the anaerobic capacity a bit more. Rather than me say, well, Keith, you know, his anaerobic capacity, look, he's, because I know that, but I'm wanting Keith to tell me what, because first of all, he gets to speak, he gets to feel valued. He can then say what he thinks. I get to learn.
Yep.
And then I can come in and say, yeah, I'm seeing that too. Like, what's the plan? Can we?
So that's be heard. So don't be late. Be heard. Third one.
I would say, it's the application. I would say the application. So, I mean, another good little tip, actually, we used to get the players to rate themselves 1 to 10.
Okay.
So they didn't tell us. And this came from, it was David Young and I sat down one day. I said, all right, how are we going to get this environment? And we wrote down some things that we wanted. And so it comes to motivation, really. So you've got to be motivated to do something. So, but you can't always enjoy what you're going to do. So what, for example, you know, a player might enjoy being on court, but they don't enjoy the hard kind of hard interval VO2 max thing. But they're going to enjoy what it's going to lead to. So they do what's necessary. And this is what top players do. They don't always do what they want to do. They do what is necessary as a complete player.
Yeah.
So we'd intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. So it'd be like, intrinsic would be, I enjoy doing this task. I love hitting a ball, but I don't really like doing this gym work. But I know that it's going to allow me to get to a ball quicker and faster and for longer and allow me to use my skills. So I need to do that. I know I need to do that. Don't enjoy it, but I need to do it. Now that's extrinsic. So that's the outcome. You know, you've got the outcome, and then the process is going to lead to that. So we would get the players to rate themselves. Say, right, where are you today? They turn up. I'd be going around while they're doing the little warm-ups and their TheraBand work, and you know, you'd be having these little chats and say, you know, where are you? And there'd be a little smile on the face. And yeah, mostly it'd be, they're pretty high. You know, they're pretty up for it. And you've got to be up for every session, really. But you can have those days where you're not. You know, something might have happened, your cat's died, argument with your girlfriend, whatever it might be. Just something's happened. And it's, you know, I'd say to them, that's fine. You know, that's fine. If you're a 6, how are you going to get to a 7 or an 8 or a 9? You know, and you can't always be a 9 out of 10. And this is the same for any world-class athlete. I know how they operate, I know how they think, and it's hard to be there every day. That's why you need your easier days sometimes just to recover and regenerate. And that's how you get long-term resilience. But we'd say out of 10. And you go under them, and you could see, and what it does, again, it raises their awareness, because they're like, okay, yeah, I'm probably in their own head, they're probably thinking, well, yeah, I'm a bit of a 6 or a 7 out of 10. And all I'd say to them is, look, if you're a bit low today, that's fine. You know, either go home and recover and come back again. But just remember this, for every bum day that you have, your rival's had a good day. So you've just lost 2 days. They've gone forward a day and you've gone backwards. Because you never stagnate. Fitness or growth, it doesn't stagnate. You're either moving forwards or you're moving backwards. So you either accept that on that particular day and you get yourself up for it, or you don't, you avoid it and you go the other way. And I think the best in the world class is about being up for it more than others and applying yourself and having an application and that.
So your 3 non-negotiables then to set the basis of a great team would be, never be late, always be on time and be prepared.
Yeah, I mean, be prepared, yeah.
Okay.
Be at your best. You've got to be at your best.
Work in a team where you can be heard, so that you can give your views and people will listen to your views to understand really what's happening. So that's listening. And then the final one is be self-aware about where you are at all times. So if you're only at a 6.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's a lot of, you know, within this, there's a lot of kind of empathy and emotional intelligence. So it's not like we're going around saying to players, look, if you're 6 out of 10 today, forget it. Yeah, there's a lot of empathy and thing, and you've got to look at people and realize that sometimes they're not there today, and that's fine. You know, that's absolutely fine. People have things, and you can't be at that level. But what you've got to understand is that you're wanting to be a world class. You've got aspirations to be this good, or you're a team that's aspiring to be doing this. You know, whether in your industry, whether it's the best products or the right pricing or customer service, you're going to have all those goals, and it requires a lot of effort. It's all that's the fluffy stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
All the branding, all the everything, whatever it might be that you're looking to attain, that's in the future. You can't control that. What you can control is what you do on a daily basis. So the things we do on a day-to-day basis, consistently, to high standards, that's not fluffy. That's not at all fluffy. That's tough. That is very tough.
So it's repetitively doing the simple stuff that lays the platform.
Yeah, it's a lot of repetition and a lot of and I call it like winning behaviors. So winning behaviors and action. So if you want to win something, if you want to win something, like your team wants to win something, or an individual, if they want something, if they've got a goal, then it's those. Forget about the winning, because the winning's, like I said, it's in the future. You can't control that. It's the winning behaviors and the actions that we take that will lead to the outcome, to the success or lack of success. So, it's a fine line, really.
We talked about my podcast plan. We've gone out the window, haven't we? Classic podcast this. We start in one place and then go over, which has been really interesting. But just to try and just bring it back together a little bit. We have been talking about all the things you've learned out of sports coaching that we can apply outside in organisations, in amateur sport, in business situations. There were five things that we talked about trying to cover, and we've kind of covered them. Should we try and summarise them?
Yeah.
For the listeners, because it's been absolute gold dust what you've been talking about. But I think if we can just pull them together a little bit, that's what I'm really interested in is really, what are your two or three tips on each of these subjects that we outside the sporting world can take back into our worlds and use? So the first one was, what separates the very best in the world from the rest?
The very best will thrive under pressure, generally. I mean, I'm not saying they don't get nervous, because they're human, they've got emotions, but because they've done the work and they know they've done the work. And I'm not talking about how talented they are. They know that they're physically prepared. Yeah, it's like being ready for an exam. If you've revised and studied, you're actually looking forward to going to that exam, because you're going to score well.
Yeah.
So it's the same sort of thing. Or for a job interview, if you've prepared really well and you've got knowledge and you feel comfortable going into that interview, you're going to thrive in that interview.
It's been really interesting listening to this, because you keep reaffirming The basics.
That's what elite sport is, and we can learn so much from elite sport, I think.
So elite sport is driven by the basics. It's not about them.
It's about the basics. It's about doing the basics brilliantly, and then at world class, at pace, but do the basics brilliantly and do that consistently.
And you get that by just repetition.
A lot of repetition. I mean, it is repetition. I'm going to get into the skill acquisition thing. Just a little thing on that, but. Yeah.
I'll come to that next.
Yeah.
So this is a question from Barry Shorrock, who's a sales director for Flexar, one of the roofing companies that we deal with. And his question is, I'm going to paraphrase it slightly. When you've got the best of the best at a level, because they've got all of the basics right, they've got the skill set, the skill acquisition all sorted out. What's the little 1% difference that takes them from good to amazing?
Yeah, and that's linked to the previous question. So when I say top players, the very best thrive under pressure, they get nervous. They get nervous. My brother got nervous, okay? But he was well prepared. And I think the best players don't stay in that emotion for too long. So what happens is they're in that final. It means so much to them. They want to win. You're under pressure, okay? But when I say you thrive, you're going to feel that. You're going to feel the pressure. You're going to feel it. But the way they look at it is, well, where would I rather be? Would I rather be in this final, under pressure, feeling like I am, feeling nervous, fear of losing, all these emotions that you get, fear? Or would I rather be at home, sat on the couch, watching this because I'm not good enough? So pressure is actually a privilege. And I think the best players in the world, the best performers in the world, when they go onto stage or they play, my brother is very good at acting as well. It's quite annoying, really. He's actually a really good actor. He played lead part in The Sound of Music, Captain Von Trapp. He plays the guitar, he can sing, he can act.
What does he do now?
He's actually coaching. He's coaching. Coach. But he does act. I mean, he does theatre.
Is he as good as coach as you?
I think he's very, very, I mean, he's good. He's great. I mean, he's coaching the World Number 1 at the moment.
Oh.
But again, it's not something that he goes into and he's looking at you and going, right, we're going to do this with the grip and this. He coaches the person. He understands that. He understands that to get to where you are, it's about investing.
You coach individually and coach the person.
Yeah.
So that's in terms of answering Barry, once you've got everybody to a certain level, the bit that separates the great from the elite is mindset.
Yeah, I would say it's, yeah. I mean, the top 10 players in any sport, if you look at it, you know, they're all good. They're all very good.
Yeah.
Technically, there's not really much weakness. And okay, there might be some have got slightly better this and that. But I think what separates is the ability to respond when you lose a point or there's like a little bit of a, you know, lose a match.
So think clearly under pressure. So that's Clive Woodward's teacup from...
Yeah. Respond. They reframe things. They don't dwell. They don't get negative. They find solutions. They seek challenges. They're curious. They want to know. You know,
the theme from all of this, which is really interesting for me, is get the basics right. It's mindset. It's be curious. Be self aware. It's never stop learning.
Being that good at something is actually very boring. There's a lot of sacrifice you've got to make. I mean, a lot of players work the day backwards. Yeah, you know, they'll look at my second session is going to finish at 5 p.m. So it's going to start at 2:30 with my rehab and my prehab and activation. And and then that means I've got to have lunch by 12 because it's got to settle. Then I've got to finish my morning session by 11:30. I've got to start that. That means I'm going to start by 9:30, which means I have breakfast by 7:30, which means I need 11 hours sleep. I've got to be in bed by 11, lights out. 11:30.
So this is the glamour of elite sport.
Yeah.
Is it thinking like,
I mean, I'm giving you a bit of an example, but I'm not saying would do that, but that's generally, I'm not saying it's intense. I'm just saying it's focused. It's like your recovery and your recovery and your nutrition and your sleep
is just as important as
putting the hard yards in, because that allows you to train hard.
Talk to me then about skill development.
Okay, so my brother was probably regarded as the most skillful player in the game, and I was regarded, you know, as a young player. But James was better than me. But he... This isn't my opinion. This is fact. So there's a thing called myelin, which is it's a neural receptor, if you like. It's a holy grail of skill acquisition. So if you want to improve something, so if anybody's listening, they've got a young child and they want to get better at something, this is basically, in terms of just pure skill. I'm not talking mindset, although mindset, you do need mindset to be able to want to do this, because it requires a lot of repetition. Basically, myelin is a neural receptor. So the body's made up of nerve fibers. Mm. And if you imagine it, myelin is like the rubber insulator that wraps around the copper fiber. And every time you do a movement or an action, you get these electrical impulses. Okay. So it's a bit like super fast fiber broadband. The more you wrap and you train the neural pathways in a good way, practice, purposeful practice, you know, the 10,000 hours. So you do this repetition, hitting the ball well, technically, or performing a skill. And you see it with the kids on PlayStation. They're playing PlayStation. They spend hours and hours on PlayStation or Xbox, and they're trying to get to level 4, and they keep failing at the end of level 3, and they keep going and keep going, repetition, and then they get to level 4, and they spend a similar amount of a couple of days, hours, level 4, failing at level 4, get to level 5, and you just keep going. And what you're doing is you're wrapping this rubber insulator around these nerve fibers, and these electrical impulses. So what it means is that it seals it. And there's no leaks. And so your thoughts and your thought process and your movements become super fast fiber broadband. They fire very quickly. And that's what elite sport is. So you look at someone like, an example would be somebody like Brazil or Spain. So in what typically happens is they play this game called futsal, which is on small pitches. Overcrowded. I mean, in Brazil, they were playing on the streets, on the beach, overcrowded pitches. There's no time to, on a big full-size pitch, like condition games, skill acquisition games. Yep. There's no time to look down, hold the ball, look up, see who's there, and then pass it. It just has to move quickly because you've got three or four players on you because there's no room. There's so many kids there playing. And so they intrinsically, okay, unwittingly. But we know that neuroscience, neurology, that this is how it works. So it's not fact, it's fact, sorry. Yeah. So these impulses have been fired up. The ball's arriving at them and they're moving it on, using all parts of the body apart from the hands, and into space, having to read situations very quickly and move and try and find space. And that's like the super fast fiber broadband thing. I mean, Desmond Douglas was many years ago, he said to have the fastest hands on the planet at table tennis. And he'd simply got into table tennis because a PE teacher on the street played table tennis at his school. So all the kids had table tennis tables because he used to play table tennis in PE. And his garage was like a three-quarter garage. So the full-size table tennis table, he stood literally right against the back wall. Yeah, and so he had no room. So as the ball comes over the net, he's having to...
Move twice as quickly.
So he's got less time to process the information and read the visual clues and things. And that's what we do. You know, we create condition games, skill acquisition games, which builds this myelin and repetition. So you're building your technical skill, but you're also doing it with decision-making involved. And then that's when you get really fast fiber.
Can you see that applying in a work situation?
Well, that's what elite sport is, isn't it? Basics brilliantly at pace. That's what it is. So,
and in business, you think that could be a mantra for all of us?
I think it's repetition, doing something really well. You've got to do it really well. Yeah. So whether that's customer service, you know, you've got to practice, you know, the customer service element. You know, it's trainable. You know, it's you're training for that, surely. You know, marketing. Yeah, that's trainable. Everything's trainable. You know,
so learn your skills, repeat.
And yeah, you get repeat your skills, but you've got to repeat and wrap those neural fibers pathways in the right way. So I've had players come to me that have got, you know, they're not holding the racket correctly, the footwork, the body position, all that kind of stuff. So you correct all that, and then you've got to do the loads and lots and lots of practice over that. I mean, there's four things in squash. Any squash people listening, there's only four things that I look at technically, and that's grip, footwork, body position, and swing. And the swing being three parts: preparation, impact point, follow through. So, for example, if your follow through comes around your body, you're not going to hit the ball straight. If your feet aren't placed correctly, you're not going to be balanced. Yeah. Or if your body's not behind the ball, you know, you're gonna the alignment's going to be out. So there's all these sorts of things. That are contributing to the success of the shot or not. And it contributes to the decision-making. Now, when you get your technical abilities and your decision-making skills in order, so there's a technical skill, which is a technical skill of, you know, holding the racket and your footwork and your body position, those four elements I've just mentioned, but then that will then allow good decision-making. Because if you can perform a skill, it opens the doors to better decisions. And you combine the two and you wrap those regularly through simple technical skill exercises combined with skill acquisition condition games for the decision making and the speed of it, that's like really skillful, and that's skill acquisition, and that builds confidence because you get assurance from that, because you're assured, you've got assurance, so that builds confidence. And then confidence brings mentality, it brings, you know, I'm backing myself. So when you get into tight situations like the Brazilian footballers, and they've got three or four England defenders around them, you'll see.
So you are just reaffirming the importance of mindset in everything. We've got one final question that came in. It's from Toby Jane, who is a sales development exec for BizTech PLC. And Toby asks, I've played squash since I was eight and was in the England squash setup as a junior, where I had the best experience and developed a lot of skills that I still use today. I remember the anxiety, pressure and excitement I used to get before going on court. Would love to hear how David helps junior players navigate these feelings, as it's likely the first time they're going to be exposed to them.
Yeah. Again, we'll probably, I think in that situation with the juniors, we just say, you know, look, enjoy competing. You know, you're going to learn a lot from this. We talk about the winning, the losing. You know, it's a win-win, because if you win, that's great. If you lose, then we can investigate and have a look and learn from that. Yeah. And then you grow, and then that helps you, because, you know, as we mentioned, all world and ones lose, so it's not a problem to lose. You know, you need a lot of failures, so you kind of take the pressure off the result, really, and talk about the performance. You know, did you perform well? Did you warm up properly? Did you prepare yourself? Did you give your best? I mean, my two kids play, and they're 7 and 9, and all we ask of them is just behave yourself, have fun, and give your best. Okay. And then we're happy, and that's it.
Brilliant.
So that, you know, the pressure is taken away from the result then. Because enough pressure they're going to feel. Of course they're going to think about the result.
I like that point you made earlier about it's actually an honour to have the pressure because you've got yourself to that point. So rather than fear it, you should welcome it because it means you've been a success.
Yeah, yeah. Embrace it and it is a privilege. It is a privilege. If you're feeling pressure, and again, in any industry, if you're feeling pressure, it's generally because you're good at something.
Yeah.
You know, you somebody's paying you to do a job or you're in an important match or whatever it might be. There's pressure in everything.
So what's for David Campion now then, having stepped away from England squash after 20 years?
Enjoying spending a bit more time with the kids, but this Olympic program role is good. You know, that's great. That keeps me involved. My identity feels like it is in squash. Yeah. You know, that's where
we can't do 23 years in something.
It's been a lifetime, isn't it, since I was seven. So I've been in the game a long time and, you know, it's something I'm very passionate about and I like helping others. I mean, as a coach, you know, in the early years, maybe not so, but you soon grow to realize that actually I'm good at helping people. I like helping people and it gives you a lot of personal reward. So I think squash is where I'm known and I enjoy that. I'm also enjoying talking in the business sector a little bit, doing some corporate events and things. And that's something that's quite new to me. But again, you know, a lot of the content is very transferable. And, that's something, it's just a bit of diversification, which I'm enjoying. I'm helping, China, for example, have just started to take off a little bit in squash. And I'll be going over to Shanghai soon with the family. I've been invited over. There's a club there and they've got a big junior program. I'm going to help the coaches and look at how they set things up and how they train the players. And so I'll be using a lot of my experiences with England, like I'm doing with Italy, to help China in the private sector.
So you're really not taking it easy after England then? You've got Italy, you've got China.
Yeah, but a lot of these things will, it's where I can take my family as well. I remember my kids, you know, give them some life experiences traveling to different places. So I mean, it's not like I'm in control of it as well. I think with England, you know, working with England squash, although massively enjoyed it and I always felt really valued and well supported at England and I wouldn't have stayed that long if I didn't. But I think you find that you become almost a little bit institutionalised. This is what I do and this is who I am. And and you're going from pillar to post and traveling around the world. And my kids are young. I mean, they're like 7 and 9 now. So last year when I stopped, you know, I realised that it's time to spend more time. I don't want to miss out on too many things. Then they get to like 14 and then I think, right, I'm going to finish now. I'm like, well, I don't really want to know you anymore. So they're off with their mates.
What do the kids think having you back in their lives now?
No, well, it's funny because when I used to come back from somewhere, I'd be off at, say, the US Open, I'd come back and I'd be away at a junior event somewhere and they'd be like, well, you've just got back. You're going away again. And, you know, when your 6, 7-year-old saying that to you, it
pulls at the heartstrings.
Yeah, I think when they're really young, like 2 and 3, they don't really, but at the age that we're getting at, I think it was just starting to bother me a bit.
I've got two more questions for us to wrap up. I'll give you some warning of the second one, which is what we always finish on, is the best piece of advice you've ever been given through your career. So hold that thought.
Yeah.
So my second to last
question.
That somebody's given to you, piece of advice you've been given that kind of sticks with you. That'll be the final question. But just picking up on the point of you starting to talk in the business world and sharing some of the stuff that you've learned. We've covered a huge amount of ground today. Really, you know, interesting stuff. I love all this stuff. I'm a big sports fan myself. So it's been really interesting. I thank you for sharing. But if you had to give three pieces of advice to the business world about how to build great individuals, the best teams, based on everything that we've talked about today, what would be the three focus areas?
I would say you need to be clear on what your goals are and then work backwards from that.
Yep.
But I call the goal like the higher purpose. So the higher purpose is we're looking to achieve this, whatever that might be, more productivity, sales. For us, it was gold medals. So then we work backwards and we call it the critical path. We work backwards from that. So that it's like the sat nav. How are we going to get there? If you're not, it needs to be accurate and precise, doesn't it? So you need precision and accuracy on how you're going to achieve that. And it's not fluffy.
It's very black and white, very clear.
So
what it's going to be.
Okay, we want to increase our sales. How are we going to do that? Who's in the team? How who's going to help us do this?
Yep.
And then you involve everyone, you know, and you let them be heard.
Yep.
Make them need to feel valued. Because if they don't feel valued, then you're not going to get the output from them. You know, you want take people on a journey. It needs to be like a transformational environment.
Okay. So, so higher purpose, clarity of goal would be one.
Yeah, and it needs to be a transformational environment. And what I mean by that is, it's not a transaction. We are paying you an amount of money and you will give me this back.
Yeah.
It's like, look, we want to go on a journey. Do you want to come with us? You know, how can you input?
So turn all journeys into transformations, not transactions.
It's a journey. It's a journey. It's got to feel like a team. It's no point being a team if it's not a team. If it's one or two individuals that are directing and making it feel like a bit of a toxic environment where you're just showing up.
Yeah.
You don't want to just show up. You want to give and help others. I mean, in the army, in the military, it's all about, you know, the servant kind of, we serve to lead.
Yeah.
I mean, we did quite a lot of bit with the military, actually, with our players. I mean, you know, some big stuff in there. But I think that's a very important thing.
And then number three,
for teams.
Yeah, how do you build? What can you take from what you've learned in coaching in squash and put into business? The first one is establish a really clear higher purpose. Two, aim to make it transformational rather than transactional. So take people on that journey with you, consult, engage, help people grow as they go along. What would the third one be?
Yeah, I would say for the leaders, whoever's leading that, to just allow everyone to be heard. Allow everyone to be heard. So in many ways, you're speaking last, aren't you? You speak last. Speak last. Let them speak. Let them be heard. You get to learn. You know, we've got two ears for listening, one mouth. The ears are there to, you've got to listen. You've got to allow people to be heard.
Can I just add to that? Kind of 4 months into my coaching course, and all we're laboured with as learning to be a coach is listen.
Yeah.
Downturn, which is perfectly we
have this model: show, tell, discuss, ask, allow. It's not really a model. It's how I coach. Show, tell, discuss, ask, allow. So show is you demonstrate. You might look at some video you're showing so they can copy. You tell. Sometimes you've got to tell and instruct and just be direct. That's fine as well, but not too much of that. And then allow it to unfold. You know, let them fail a little bit. It's okay, make it safe. Psychologically safe, the third one. It's gotta be psychologically safe. So when it's psychologically safe and you allow people to fail and make mistakes and they feel safe in that environment or safe or missing a shot and you're not chastising them it's gonna allow people to, they're gonna wanna push boundaries. They'll want to innovate. And we don't wanna cap players or cap people. You wanna allow them to grow and try new things and fail a bit. And so make it psychologically safe to do that.
I like that.
So that's the third one. So when you ask me three things, that'd be the third one.
I'm going to keep that fourth one in though, is allow people to be heard.
Yeah.
Because that's really pertinent to what I'm doing at the minute and this whole thing of listening. So to be heard, you've got to have people who can listen to you. So your advice.
Yeah, but I mean, in coaching, so if I'm coaching a player, show, tell, discuss, ask, allow, I'd be the same with your employee. If you're a boss or if you're a leader, you know, just because you're in a position of authority, you've got to empower. Grow yourself, but take people with you
on the journey. So it's higher purpose.
Yeah.
Be clear on your goals and work back from there. Make it a transformational rather than a transactional journey that brings people along with you and encourages them and give a psychologically safe space.
The environment needs to be psychologically safe.
Perfect.
Because then you need that emotion, and to be psychologically safe, you need emotional intelligence. You need empathy. There needs to be an act of kindness.
This is a proper lesson now. This.
I'm talking about my experiences with coaching players.
Yeah, no, it's good.
I know what kind of works and what doesn't through trial and error. Yeah. I made a lot of mistakes. Remember, I'm 53.
That's good. So our final question.
Yeah.
The best piece of advice you've been given in your career?
The best piece of advice was later on, actually. It was like, look after your body, but I didn't look after my body. I mean, for my sport anyway.
Yeah. You know, outside of best piece of coaching advice then that we could use in our world, our lives?
I think it's preparation. Be prepared. I think be prepared. Your preparation will lead to a performance of whatever that performance is. So it take the time.
Take the time to prepare to be ready to go when you need to go.
Yeah, the winning comes well before the winning. It's all about the preparation.
That's very profound. Yeah. The winning comes before the winning. I like that.
So yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's what I would say in terms of that. That, you know, if you want to be good at something, it's not being good on the day. The only reason why you're good on the day is because of what's come before.
Beforehand. That's brilliant. It's a great way to finish. Thank you so much for giving up your time to come to a little old Howarth podcast. I was quite dumbfounded when you said yes, you'd come, because to have somebody with, you know, 20 years of elite coaching experience, it's just a great guest for us. And I think the stuff that you've shared with us has been amazing. Good luck with everything that you're doing moving forward with the Italian team, with the Chinese, with the Indian guys that you're working with. And I hope it makes you all very happy and you get that great balance of life and work. So good luck in everything that you do. To our listeners and audience, thank you for joining us. It's much appreciated. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you enjoyed what you've heard and seen, it would be great if you could like and subscribe to any of our feeds and spread the word to anybody else that you know that you think might be interested. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you again soon.
One, bye.